Hello. So I'm very glad to be able to present you Kim Ickes and Janet McCabe, who have contributed already a lot to our issue we were talking about in the last 3 days. They have appeared in various events like this, published a lot of articles in the important books about the issue. You are both teaching in London as well as...
We edit a journal, Critical Studies in Television, which is the first and only international television journal. We also teach television at Birkbeck, Royal Holloway and Manchester Met. So we're a bit peripatetic.
All right. And you were two of the first I tried to get in touch with here, and you were kind of the last to finally reach, so I'm very glad it worked out and to have you here.
Thank you. Okay, so first of all, we'd like to say, as kind of the last speakers, thank you so much for inviting us, and last but not least, I'm glad that we actually got here. Thank you also to Kirsten, who's unfortunately had to go, and Sabine, who've worked so hard to organise this. We really appreciate everything they've done. And also to all the fantastic kind of behind-the-scenes people. We've actually organised conferences, and we know how hard it is. So we'd just like to say thank you to everyone. It's really nice of you to invite us.
And finally, just before we start, we'd also like to thank you for speaking in English. We've come all the way to Stuttgart, and you know where really we should be speaking German. And you've been so delightful and very patient with the English speakers. We apologise, but we're going to be speaking in English
again
this afternoon.
Okay. To start.
So, what has HBO ever done for women? Carmela Soprano.
Ruth Fisher.
Brenda Chenoweth.
Carrie Bradshaw.
Samantha Jones.
Alma Garrett.
Calamity Jane.
And the sister wives of Bill Henriksen, Barbara, Nicolette and Margene.
These are just some of the most compelling female characters on contemporary television, courtesy of HBO's original series. But strong, complex women have long existed on US television screens. It is, after all, what television does best. From Lucy Ricardo to Roseanne, from Mary Richards to Dorothy Spornak, from Christine Cagney and Mary Beth Lacey to Alexis Carrington and Sue L. Ewing, all unforgettable women. But HBO's recent crop of truly troubling, yet always mesmerising women has left audiences and critics sensing that the premier cable channel is doing something with gender and sexuality not seen elsewhere.
But are these female characters truly breaking new ground, contributing to a vibrant conversation on the state of contemporary feminism, female identities, and the dilemmas facing modern womanhood in a post-feminist age?
Or are they merely recycling age-old stereotypes under new guises?
HBO has long made a virtue out of its autonomy from the constraints and restrictions limiting network television. Doing different, setting itself against what's prohibited elsewhere on mainstream broadcasting channels, has emerged as a crucial institutional strategy for HBO. Arguably, the complex women starring in its original programmes are produced in and through an institutional discourse that works hard to tell us how HBO defies, resists and scandalises.
But let's be cautious, for, as Tanya Maleski eloquently puts it, we exist inside ideology that we are all victims down to the very depths of our psyches, of political and cultural domination. HBO does not function outside of culture. It is, in fact, always inside cultural discourse and subject to its rules, prohibitions, and controls governing norms of gender and sexuality. Bonnie Dow said it best when she writes, "We need to appreciate media for what it can do in giving us images of strong women, yet at the same time, we need to maintain a very keen sense of the limitations of media logic."
Our contribution to this symposium and aim of our paper today is to offer a feminist reading and extend the above thinking to suggest that the HBO original series conflate the terms intertextuality and self-reflexivity, first introduced by Jane Foyer in 1984. When referring to intertextuality, she means incorporating previous generic forms and elements into a new text, and self-reflexivity, when a text self-consciously refers back to itself. Both terms are associated with modernist art and are self-conscious strategies. But whereas one term is about adaptation and revision, the other is about doing different, about distinguishing itself from other texts, deconstructing its own genre and style as it inherits its own forms and as it practices them. Our claim is that the HBO original series collapsed the two terms into one text. So while The Sopranos may plunder past generic references, both filmic and televisual, it also, at the same time, does something completely different as it deconstructs itself as a way of distinguishing its quality from regular network TV. Paradox and ambiguity arise from such a structural tension. But what intrigues us most is not only how that contradiction is made visible in and through the textual construction of these women, because they most often take on the narrative task of deconstruction, but that in turn they emerge as strong and complex precisely because they are produced in and through representational structures struggling over questions of power. Who has the right to speak, to tell their story, and shape how that story is told? And that complexity in turn speaks of our troubled age of emancipation, the post-feminist condition, courtesy of HBO.
Long have we, as scholars, been drawn to female characters who struggle to make sense of, as well as speak about, sex and sexuality, desire and romance, agency and power, life choices and identities, as they often function in constricting narrative worlds that do them few favours. Whereas HBO promotes itself as offering new directions, new opportunities for doing different, and producing representations that challenge the norm, why then, we ask, do HBO offer us, on the surface at least, a range of decidedly unliberated women? From bare-breasted pole dancers to kept women modelling Versace dresses and long-suffering housewives alone in their pristine kitchens to financially independent and sassy career women obsessed with Manola Blahniks and the quest for Mr. Right. And that is to say nothing of the Hendrickson sister wives in Big Love with their polygamous lifestyle, mixed feelings, complicated sleeping rotas, the choices and actions of the sister wives seemingly at odds with feminism. Find us, as scholars, struggling for theory to open up these most unpromising representations to meaning.
Implanted in its original programming philosophy and made intelligible in each original series, HBO, to a certain extent, imposes new norms for television fictions. It has changed perceptions of television, of what is possible to represent on the small screen. Yet to utter the new is no easy matter, and what the subscription channel has done with its original programming has proved sufficiently groundbreaking that at first HBO had to account for its existence and take charge of what made it unique. By appropriating a modernist impulse, as defined by Jane Foyer, of intertextuality and self-reflexivity, not only sets its originals apart from regular television, but also bears, we would suggest, traces of a cultural elitism rooted in the longer history of American quality television, with its modernist self-consciousness, its values and taste formations. As if reputable associations are essential before a discourse of what constitutes originality in television drama can be articulated and or accepted. HBO may tell us that The Sopranos, for example, is not television, but it does so based on established values, tastes, and assumptions of what that might mean in the first place.
Some of HBO's most successful originals are rooted in classic US generic forms, the Western, the gangster, the rom-com. Appropriating classic US cultural traditions, canonical textual forms, literary, theatrical, and performative, and those that enjoy a privileged place within the American cultural imagination, means that the originals can determine their own value. It is when the original inhabits its a particular privileged form that HBO becomes entangled in debates about reputation, taste, values, and respectability. And it is why we would argue that debates over the use of profanity in profanity are more fiercely fought over series like Deadwood than Oz or The Wire. But, and this is crucial, HBO's originals critically intervene within the intrinsic forms, generic formats, and aesthetic conventions on which our knowledge of a genre is made possible in the first place. A pragmatic business decision may be a sense of doing different on which the HBO brand is based. But originality emerges out of the tension and complexity of HBO's reliance on a canonical narrative and generic conventions, and its texts involve a continual dialogue between the different and sometimes apparently contradictory textual and generic elements. It is the process of making those codes visible that becomes the contrapuntal function of women, allowing us to read the canon differently.
Turning first to The Sopranos, orthodox studies on the gangster genre observe a narrative hostility towards women. As representational types, they fall into two broad categories: a virgin, mothers and sisters, and femme fatale, sophisticated moles, mistresses, prostitutes. The mobster has never had much regard for the narrative position of women, focusing instead on his own generic need, as Robert Warshaw describes, to assert himself as an individual, to draw himself out of the crowd. Establishing the woman as inferior other emerges as a generic necessity, for it is against her that the film gangster can define himself as subject and strengthen his own narrative authority. The ambivalence created by and embodied within the Madonna-whore dichotomy serves to construct women as narratively subservient and subject to sexist practices, male humiliation, violence and patriarchal control. It's our contention that underpinning this most patriarchal of generic forms, complex women came to guide, shape and reorder, for better or worse, the complicated narrative world of Tony Soprano brought to television. One only need think of the weekly opening credits, when Tony drives from the fringes of New York City with its fast-paced rhythms and generic associations with gangsters, harsh brutality and petty crime, up to his front door in the leafy New Jersey suburbs, home to his wife Carmela and their two children. Structured here is the central narrative conflict of The Sopranos, which demands that Tony must relinquish male mob violence in order to function within the feminine and feminizing domestic spaces of hearth and home. Women, long denied an authoritative voice within the self-contained cinematic world of defined male action, subtly shape this serial arc, an episodic storytelling structure defined by ambiguity and contradiction. As we begin to read contrapuntally, there's a simultaneous awareness both of the long generic history and of those subjected and concealed voices against which the dominant narrative has traditionally acted.
In the patriarchal world par excellence of the mafia, where women are unlikely to be running the firm or even considered important enough to matter beyond providing domestic support, Carmela has long understood the formidable power embedded in roles in which no one pays much attention, And it's worth remembering that the soprano women do not even figure on the FBI flowchart of mafia connections. More for them. Given that the gangster genre offers us a dominant filmic discourse on power, in which the generic codes and conventions compel characters to act and behave in certain ways, Carmela takes great pains to be seen playing by the rules. She operates inside meticulous codes of marriage sanctified by the Catholic Church, of motherhood extolled by popular media rhetoric, of family valorized by the mafia and its generic laws. It is a lesson in unseen power, whereby the legitimate wife and mother quite literally lay down the law. She's privileged. She is privileged. No wonder Tony complains that Carmela breaks his balls. Yet, he can do nothing about it. Her power comes from acting out, as Michel Foucault says, that which we no longer perceive as the effect of power that constrains us. Steely silences, reproachful looks that often speak louder than any words Carmela could utter, one stern look from her can stop Tony dead in his tracks. He often finds it difficult to resist his wife, and even if he does say no, she will find another line of attack before he gives in. Season 4 opener finds Carmela worried about the family finance. After seeing Puss's widow handing out kielbasa samples at the local supermarket, Carmela becomes apprehensive about her long-term future. She picks her moment. Serenaded by Dean Martin crooning Time for the Cowboy to Dream, Tony prepares for a quiet evening in, relaxing in front of the television, watching Rio Bravo and eating his ice cream sundae. His guard down, his mouth is full, Carmela picks her moment.
Damn cursor again. If only Tony watched the news, rather than reruns of old Hollywood movies, he would understand that everything comes to an end. Tony may think this conversation is at an end, but Carmela knows different. It will take the entire season, but she will get what she wants. It's almost as if Carmela has read her Jane Foyer on generic TV forms as potentially progressive texts. She performs melodramatic victim over an entire season. She's pitch perfect. Tearful recriminations, locking herself in the bathroom, afternoons spent curled up on the couch, playing the disrespected wife, the neglected spouse. Clandestine trips to the backyard storage bin and silently pushing papers in front of Tony for him to sign, finds Carmela working her angle. Tony may command the 60-minute filmic narrative, but it is Carmela that takes control of the 13-episode televisual arc that unsettles any authority he may think he has. By the end of this season, she has a diverse portfolio and a second home on the coast. Result.
Produced in ambiguous and contradictory forms associated with melodrama and soap opera, and forged from competing representational archetypes ranging from domestic goddess to melodramatic matriarch, characters like Carmela, we would argue, struggle in and through representation. But this is no easy matter. Dedicated viewers know that women like Carmela own, as Regina Bracca claims, the world of the emotions in The Sopranos. It's their turf, their thing. Way past when a film or television text would have punished women for resisting patriarchal law, for rejecting the patriarch and owning their own desires, The Sopranos presents us with women cognizant of the collateral damage that will be sustained in the narrative turf war with the obstinate gangster and an intransient patriarchal law. And is this not then the problem? For Carmela can never be outside the law. She is always, in fact, inside mafia power and subject to its rules, prohibitions, and controls, as well as those patriarchal fictions from which she is constructed. Look at what happens to her when she tries to effect her escape from the soprano marriage. She's soon reduced to silence and non-representation. As Foucault once wrote, one is always inside power. There is no escaping it. There is no absolute outside where it's concerned.
Yet such a representational dilemma is also rooted in the third wave feminist project, in which the subject is always in process. writes Rebecca Walker, third wave subjectivity seeks to create identities that accommodate ambiguity and our multiple positionalities, excuse me, including more than excluding, exploring more than defining, searching more than arriving. Is this not a perfect description of a television character like Carmela Soprano, a woman we find so truly compelling and terrifyingly like us? Is not the longer television series format better able to accommodate the ambiguity and a subject in the process of becoming never resolved?
How women negotiate a subjectivity that embraces contradiction and complexity is, we would argue, what these characters like Carmela Soprano or makes characters like Carmela Soprano truly gripping. Paradox and ambiguity emerge out of the tension and complexities produced in Carmela's struggle in and through representation. Women in this case act as a counterpoint between the closed patriarchal narratives and Doing Different, a mark of HBO's original series. A counter-narrative that keeps penetrating beneath the surface of the text to elaborate on the submerged but ubiquitous presence of patriarchal discourses, shaping references, rules, and attitudes of how women are and to be represented.
But surely our modern liberated ladies living and loving in Manhattan would be different. Not according to the New York Times critic Stephen Holden, writing about Sex and the City. For in this world of higher expectations and educated sexual consumerism, the old romantic myths die hard. As Carrie and her friends discover, even Manhattan's most eligible bachelors are a far cry from the sensitized Rhett Butlers and Heathcliffs of their dreams. The price of a highly refined appetite is frustration. The Sex and the City girls, Carrie, Samantha, Miranda Hobbs, and Charlotte York, on the surface at least, appear smart, sassy, independent, and in need of no man to define them. Yet beneath the confident Dolce & Gabbana-clad body armour, all is not quite as it seems. For these women, while finding new stories to tell, are still ensnared in language and modes of storytelling that define appropriate models of femininity along patriarchal lines. Something indeed seems rotten at the core of modern womanhood, in which young women appropriate the language of radical feminist politics only to retell old patriarchal fairy tales of women longing to be swept away. Yet is the question not why are women abandoning feminist thinking, but rather why is it so hard to give up on those patriarchal fantasies in the first place? In short, the language to speak about such matters may change, but the stories remain the same. Tanya Modleski and Janice Radway, in their respective works on female readership and the popularity of romantic fiction within a post-feminist age, interrogate what it is about these tales of naive heroines and dashing heroes that still finds an eager female audience. Modleski in particular notes that these popular feminine texts remain potent fantasies for their voracious female readership, ready to participate in and actively desire feminine betrayal for complex and often contradictory reasons. Women may be told it's wrong to have fantasies of rescue, but the fairy tale of being swept off one's feet is still one that's imbibed by women within our culture. Did not Carrie wonder whether, inside every confident, driven, single woman, there's a delicate, fragile princess just waiting to be saved?
While feminism has been telling women since the 70s to break free of these vicious patriarchal narrative circles, women still hold fast to these stories and even in fact perpetuate them, from popular romantic fiction to Bridget Jones's Diary. Feminists struggling with the conundrum have drawn extensively on post-structuralist thinking in which subjectivity is constituted in and through language. This argument is rooted in Assyrian logic, which argues that ideology interpolates us into accepting social roles and gender identities as immutable, and is further supported by Lacanian thinking on how structures of the unconscious position women to cling to patriarchal folklore, despite being told this in their own best interest to locate new stories that do not subjugate them.
Wendy Brown even contends that within modernity, the voicing of women's experience acquires an inherently confessional cast. The voices that emerge in Sex and the City are profoundly personal ones. The four women, the unabashed Samantha, the analytical Carrie, the cynical Miranda, and the optimistic Charlotte, stage debates around dating etiquette and sexual practice as dialogic encounters. Indiscretions confessed during a shopping trip for Manolas, smart one-liners parried while sipping Cosmos, painfully honest advice dispensed over the telephone, and anecdotes shared at brunch. Tanya Medleski describes the process of female confession as about the space of deferral. It's a space of women's hystericalization, but it's also the space of feminist politics. It takes a second woman to help confer meaning on the first woman's experience.
It's our contention to take this idea further to suggest that humour and shared laughter provide another space of deferral in Sex and the City. Humour is used to undercut female investment in patriarchal fantasies and narrative forms through revealing the constructedness of fairy tales, cultural myths and consumerist discourses that construct woman as other. Reworking the tendentious joking structure, a relationship according to Sigmund Freud involving a joker but of the sexual hostile aggression and an inactive listener, a woman starts to confess what has happened to her in such a way that solicits response from her listeners. Far from passively enjoying the pleasurable effects, the other girls provide additional narratives through advice or personal reaction to give further meaning to what is being said. Revelatory commentaries about intimate experiences or sexual encounters are routinely mocked, in which truths about bodily pleasures and sexual desire are revealed. This dialogic encounter builds to a climax, undercutting the original story to expose deeper reasons for telling the story in the first place. Poking fun at what each other has to say reveals that these women are aware that there is more at stake than feeling shame or disgust. These women are prepared to be the joker, butt, and listener of the joke as they laugh at themselves for being taken in by the patriarchal fiction and daring to speak about the uncertainty and problems it inspires for them.
Joke-making techniques used by the girls include manipulating the flexibility of language with double entendre, as well as a play with established narrative forms, often associated with women, to create new associations. This further points to how Sex and the City regularly plunders classic movie references, The Wizard of Oz, The Way We Were, to give a cinematic cause and effect coherence to what is otherwise a chaotic, open-ended TV narrative, and at the same time to talk back to canonical texts. Raising another set of textual conventions allows the girls to make sense of their confusion. X and the City finds Carrie pondering why Big decided to marry Natasha instead of her. Okay, we're there.
Miranda unlocks Carrie's emotional turmoil with one simple word, Hubble. One word thus tunes three of the girls into an entire narrative of grand passion and unrequited love. This chick flick acts as a shorthand for the girls, in which narratives are humorously hijacked to enable them to tell their stories.
It's significant, though, that the truly revolutionary character, sexual libertine Samantha Jones, has not seen the film. For she is a representation that is, to a large extent, without precedent.
Nevertheless, it leads us to ask, does not modern romantic fiction within a post-feminist age imbibe women in a new language of feminist empowerment and limitless choice, only to make visible the same old impossible fantasies? That the series is firmly embedded in our culture's continual psychic investment in virtuous heroines and sexually potent men can be of little doubt. But how these women are interrogating those stories reveals how the female narrative voice is engaged in an uneasy process of creating new discourse. So, what has HBO ever done for women, for female stories and storytelling, and for contemporary feminism?
Despite how Sex and the City sought to explode taboos surrounding female sex and erotic desire, sexual pleasure and lifestyle choices, and despite delighting in the emotional complexity of women like Carmela Soprano, who serves up her ultimatums with pineapple ricotta pie, are we not still coming up against the limits of discourse around representation and how to talk differently? These women may have taken representation to new limits and may have altered the script. After all, one wonders if shows like Desperate Housewives would have even made it to mainstream without Sex and the City. But the uncomfortable truth is, are we as liberated as the shows like to think we are?
But did HBO push it too far, or, as we would suggest, did it come up against the limits of what can and cannot be said within our contemporary culture? HBO may be offering some new forms of female subjectivity, new opportunities for transforming how women are presented on television, but it cannot avoid the broader cultural ambivalence around women, female identities and feminism, as well as coming up against the limits of the generic and textual forms as they use and practice them. So, where have all the good women gone?
Some have migrated to cable channels, where others have even gone to network. Showtime in particular has enjoyed a mini renaissance with shows like Weeds and more recently Nurse Jackie. From Nancy Botwin's drug-pushing soccer mom to Nurse Jackie Payton working in the ER of a New York hospital, this new generation of representation works hard to keep professional and personal lives separate. Jackie, for example, removes her wedding ring before starting work. Reasons for her doing so remain a mystery, but her denial of a subject position within the workplace is intriguing. And this is to say nothing of Mad Men.
Neither male nor female critic failed to pick up on the, as Kira Cochrane of The Guardian said, the chauvinism and often outright misogyny of the year 1960, the year when Mad Men was set. We could relax, safe in the knowledge that those ghastly days were far behind us. We could be comforted by the fact that the women's rights movement of the 1960s and 70s had swept away the degrading sexist attitudes and the gender inequalities portrayed in Mad Men. Or could we? Long has the issue of working women been caught up in America's cultural wars. But since 9/11, argues Susan Faludi, the retreat of working women into domesticity has become a staple of mainstream media and political discourse. Faludi contends that the 9/11 attacks on American cities led to a widespread retrosexism, a regressive impulse which reactivated a uniquely US historic imagining populated with strong, manly men and vulnerable damsels. And of course, the women of Mad Men are caught up within this dilemma and cultural confusion. But what of HBO?
What we've argued is that HBO women emerge as ambiguous and ambivalent precisely because they're made visible in and managed through coded types of discourse, institutions like family, marriage and religion, as well as cause and effect narratives and strict generic rules, a dense network of affiliations within and between formal conventions and cultural trends.
What we have learnt from Foucault is that power relations are never seamless, but are always changing, generating new forms of subjectivity, identity and culture, new opportunities for transformation. Where power exists, so does resistance. Dominant institutions and forms are always being realigned and readjusted by habits, assumptions, values and knowledge developing elsewhere, often at the margins. The dominant absorbs and is changed, but change is gradual and the shifts in power are minute.
Whereas few at HBO, neither as executive nor as producers, rarely mention the F word, the network shows from Sex and the City to Big Love nonetheless tackle similar concerns and themes preoccupying those struggling to come to terms with the feminist inheritance at a time when we're told we have unlimited opportunities and no need for feminist politics. Quoting third wave feminist Mary Lisa Johnson, even if we ultimately decide that shows like The Sopranos, 6 Feet Under, Sex and the City, and other popular original series are not feminist, the narrative arcs and visual rhetoric of these texts provide rich, energetic conversations about feminism. Thank you. I think we'll just leave Carrie up there.
Maybe it's because I've... Is this wrong? Can you hear me?
Hallo? Oh, meins war
schon. Eins, zwei. Okay, schlecht.
Can you hear me now? Yeah.
Maybe I would like to open up the discussion from the start, because not only because you have to leave soon, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also, you know, because I feel a little uncomfortable now to maybe, you know, as the man in the middle of you two now trying to, you know, to save the... how should I say, the honor of HBO or others in these respects. So, please, are there any questions?
I don't have a question, but I just... I just think that Camilla Soprano has a horrible... typical housewife power.
Absolutely, yeah.
Not more. Yeah. Then it's all right. Mm. Yeah. Just
but I think that, I mean, what intrigues us is that I think a lot of feminist scholarship has kind of left characters like Carmela behind, though. Mm. And certainly, you know, we found in our work that, you know, when, you know, our work's being reviewed in something like feminist media studies, you know, there's immediately like, well, why are these feminists talking about Carmela? She's completely irrelevant. Well, no, she's not. I mean, I come from that social background that Carmela comes from, and so does Kim. And you
Not gangsters.
Just yet. No, we are, actually. Christoph has reason to be frightened.
That
these women are left behind, and these women do pose, I think, a huge dilemma and also a challenge for feminism. And I think what we work on is that HBO, I think, have done a tremendous service to kind of address these women and look at their dilemmas. I mean, Adriana, I mean, these extraordinary characters. I mean, Trixie from Deadwood.
Ruth Fisher from Six Feet Under.
That women who really don't seem to have any power, and yet they are finding some kind of agency. And, I mean, it was kind of interesting. It was a point that Tom Fontana made about, you know, audiences finding characters, and often the characters that you find are these extraordinary women who have never been represented on the screen, or they are speaking to a life experience which, you know, feminism has really kind of really left behind.
Yeah.
And that's why we're interested in them. And I don't know if you want to add anything, but
somebody in the middle.
So, in a perfect world, how would a woman be, in your opinion, be portrayed? Like, if you go forward, let's say 10, 20 years, like, if you're saying that right now, you know, a lot of different characters are portrayed, but there's still a kind of an underlying, you know, deficit, you know, there's something missing. So, in a perfect world, how would you portray?
The one thing I would say is that I would really like to see women portrayed as women without having to bear this terrible burden of, are they feminist? Are they not feminist? Are they doing us favours? You know, are they, you know, Carmela's a housewife, and, you know, she's working in this awful kind of constrained with no power. But, you know, and so we're not allowed to talk about her. It's not so much the portrayal, I think. I'd like to see us people to be allowed to talk about them without them having to bear a terrible burden of representation. And I think the point is that we have very few female characters. And so every time something comes up, like Carmela Soprano or the Sex and the City girls, you know, there's always these huge arguments about, are they feminists, aren't they feminists? And I'd like that not to happen. I'd like that to just be, they're just good characters. As we have, you know, Tony Soprano, do we think, or is Tony Soprano representative of a gangster? Well, nobody really cares. He's just a good characterization. And I think that's when the conversation has gone far enough that we don't have to worry about these things.
And And I would sort of turn your question around slightly, because I think within mainstream American television, especially in the 1980s, that women were being portrayed as if, you know, feminism had solved all their problems. Mm. And, you know, the immediate example is Claire Huxtable, who, you know, had five kids, a full-time job, and no help. Mm. I mean, I'm sorry, you know, just what? And what I think that they're doing is sort of giving us a reality check, because the myth that women are being sold is that, you know, yes, you have equality, and to a certain extent, yes, that is happening. But there are small realities where that stuff hasn't shifted. And these sort of dramas in some ways are kind of, you know, negotiating that. And to sort of follow on from what Kim was saying, you know, I mean, one thing that we always get asked when we talk about Sex and the City, and that's from when we do radio or we're doing the books or they're being reviewed, is that one thing that occurs to us is the Sex and the City women bear an awful burden of representation in the way that the men of The Sopranos does not. Mm. We are constantly being asked about those sort of very issues, which you would never ask, a male critic in that sense. I mean, okay, we're talking about feminism, so I guess, you know, we're open to it. But also, the character that has had the most sort of press attention has been Samantha Jones. And I think what fascinates us both about her is that in some ways she is a truly revolutionary character. I mean, you know, not saying that like you'd like to be her, but you really kind of admire...
You'd like to be her friend.
You really like to be her friend.
Yeah.
But what she's doing, the fact that she doesn't know that reference from, you know, The Way We Were, because in a way she's forged of a new representational type. And, once again, when critics talk about her, and this is what we're really interested in, why do we come up against limits of language? Why can we say certain things and we can't say others when we talk about characters like her? So, you know, these are the questions that kind of fascinate us.
And, she's kind of dependent on men too. I mean, if she doesn't have a man at night, she's, it affects her mood.
Well, I think, but the point is, aren't we, you know, men and women, it's not, you know, to be a feminist doesn't mean that you don't want men around, let's be honest. It's, having...
It's about having empowerment and, the will to empower.
Equality, that's,
I really enjoyed that you were talking of HBO as an entity, as a unit, and not so much of certain artists, as being specific units, not because I think this is the real truth behind it, but it's another aspect and hasn't been talked about at all so far, or very little, or only in a very positive and enthusiastic way. But having said that, on the other hand, I think to a degree, I think The Sopranos and The Wire and Deadwood and Sex and the City are polar opposites to the way women are portrayed. Like you said already in some of your points, Sex and the City in a very traditional way is about something always in the frame of this is something that women can do now, or women are like that now, or this is possible now for women, whereas. And this, I think, is so much still entangled in this kind of old logic of it's progressive to have role models or to present something as possible, whereas a critical feminist portray in a realistic series should be about explaining why it is not the way it should be, and then also be able to give other ideas of role models than the ones in this show. So I mean, if you look if you come up again with the question of what has HBO done for women, I would think, is there something that in general one can say about HBO? And I was thinking if it's maybe one can say that it has shifted. Maybe that's a crazy generalization, but maybe it has shifted the TV series from motherless Ponderosa like. West Wing, like absent mothers with fathers and children, and Frasier-like situations, to motherless, absent fathers, where the absent fathers are but the absent fathers are present. You see them. It's about them. They're in The Wire, nearly the entire cast is absent fathers, but they are on the screen. They are not away. Mm. You see them acting. Even the woman, the most interesting female character, is an absent father, Kima is.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, I just think it's interesting that The Wire kind of excises all of the mothers, where The Corner is very much about the mothers and the family. And it just seems to us, you know, when we've talked about this, is that there's kind of brief moments where television was a very kind of female, dominated. The series were, you know, sitcoms. And then all of a sudden HBO come along and now it's very male again. And it's kind of struck us over this weekend, and every time we go to conference now, it's always about men. You know, the series do have the women are kind of out there. And so at the beginning, you know, Sex and the City, Six Feet Under, and The Sopranos had really strong female characters, and they were mothers, and they were there. And now, you know, Deadwood, the mothers are kind of peripheral, and... You know, The Wire, certainly they've gone. And it's just really interesting when you read the book, you read The Corner and you see the miniseries, that it's that's all been excised and it is about men on the street. And all I can say is I just think that it's still a male-dominated world. You know, that you do see the writers are male. You know, there's one, the Amy Palladino that you talked about, Sherman. It's just all men. And so, of course, it's again, you know, just practically, it's written from a male experience.
I mean, I suppose I'd like to say two things. I mean, first of all, I think what HBO have done is they've put women into quality, which is kind of one of the first times. And I don't mean that that they weren't there before, but I mean it in terms that the critical community, that those kind of discourses around taste and values have, you know, which, you know, are bestowed on what HBO are doing, and women are there, and it is allowing for a vibrant conversation about something. And secondly, that, I mean, something, and again, I think we would both agree that it's kind of part of the kind of HBO agenda to do different, to set itself off from mainstream media, is that this is a post-patriarchal world in some ways, but it's also a kind of post-racial world. You know, it's a world that draws a lot of its references and assumptions from counterculture, which kind of challenges, you know, the sort of hegemonicness of you know, what we traditionally think of as a patriarchal narrative. But I'm a bit nervous about saying that because I want to undercut
myself. Should be.
It's just that there is a sort of, you know, counter narrative that's going on with HBO institutionally and through the dramas.
Yeah.
We have Seiko over here, and then you.
Hi, I have two questions. One is kind of off subject, and the other one is pertains to The Sopranos. The first one was, well, since I have two prominent feminists here, I have to ask this. How did you experience the kind of girl power movement of the 90s, which always seemed such a contradiction, such a contradiction to me, you know, that you have grown women empowering themselves by behaving like girls, kind of embodied by the Spice Girls and their followers. The other question was, why did you deliberately leave out Dr., I think, what was her name, Melfi, who actually seemed to be the kind of uber woman of the series and was also dynamic with a feminine side and a very emancipated side and her ambivalent feelings towards Tony Soprano.
I'll say firstly, girl power. I think, you know, we haven't got enough time to really say what we feel about girl power and the Spice Girls, actually. So, you know, let's move on to...
I mean, again,
come on, say something.
I'll say something. I mean, the whole thing with girl power is that... you know, I'll leap in. It's that it sort of made visible that kind of post-feminist, we have liberation. But I have to say, when has liberation ever been, you know, a patriarchy is never going to disagree with women in short skirts.
Exactly,
you know, I mean, I'm sorry, you know, it's not empowerment, even though you think you own it.
And it just has led to
the raunch culture issues have been tremendously problematic. And you can see it within the theory that, you know, the feminists who have talked about it and sort of reclaimed it as their own have really come up against a lot of, well, they just get into a cul-de-sac and they have nowhere to go. So it's like change the script. So that's my issue. I think it just sort of made visible that kind of lie that young girls are sold now, that, you know, it's okay. Well, no, And the second thing is we have written quite a lot about Melfi and we didn't really have time. And I think the thing is with Melfi is that she was a tremendously important linchpin character when Livia Soprano was alive. And you could see clearly that once, you know, Nancy Marshall sadly passed on, that Melfi's role became tremendously problematic. And there was always this issue around the rape for us, that after that she became a very less potent character, partly because she didn't sell her soul to Tony by telling him. And you could sort of see that, you know, how she ended up in that narrative is so not what that character was when that and we really think that part of that reason is because Robin Green left, and Mitchell Burgess left the writing team, and you can see she was a tremendously amazing character. And then they just didn't know what to do with her in the last season. I think it's a purely industrial
and also, but I think also narratively, there was always a problem with Melfi in that, you know, that your therapy is based on being truthful. And so there was always, always going to be a problem that he could never be truthful. He could never get better. And so as the season went on and then ending with the rape, there was just nothing to do with her character. And you can see it.
Doesn't she represent the viewer?
She did at the beginning.
The viewer's interest in the series, and also the constant oscillation between fascination and disgust. And finally, she goes over to disgust, and once she's completely disgusted, the series is over.
But I don't think, you see, I don't agree. I mean, I think also that what happened was by three seasons, we're interested enough in Tony Soprano. And actually, that's another thing, is yes, I think you're absolutely right. She's linchpin and she does, you know, provide that interest and that kind of understanding of Tony Soprano, which is absolutely vital. But there comes a point that we all know and love Tony, whether we've got that insight into him or not.
Yeah. And I think there's also about, you know, again, you know, you need somebody from HBO to answer this question. But it also seems to me that Carmela was one of those hidden characters that really came through. And really... Yeah. You know, sort of, because clearly Lorraine Brocco was signalled as the female star, and suddenly it was Edie Falco. It's as if you know, we didn't need to be told about, you know, we discovered Edie. You know, I think there's something there as well. But obviously we need a writer
develops
from
you
HBO
need to,
that, you know, some characters take on a life that
we need Robin Green here.
Yeah, we need Robin Green here.
As the title of your address is, what has age been undone for women? So I remember just something in Sex and the City, which is really, I didn't know that from other series. For instance, if it concerns career, women's career and career killers, and as far as I know, Miranda was pregnant, and she was it in real time in the theories. I think it, I'm not even sure, no?
Yeah, well, kind of.
More or less, and she was fed afterwards, and they didn't write her off of the script. They wrote her in. And this is something really friendly for women. I mean,
and also Sarah Jessica Parker was actually pregnant, and they just ignored it. So, you know, she's so tiny, and she just got bigger and bigger over the season, and nobody said anything about it. It was just amazing.
I think it's these sort of moments when the series actually sort of pushes it to a limit and actually does begin to change the dog. And then there's the scene at Atlantic City where somebody says she's fat, and then suddenly she loses weight and she can get into her skinny jeans again. And, I mean, it's one of the big criticisms, which goes back to the sort of girl power question just a moment ago, is about, you know, that we're still trapped within those discourses, you know, that they are all, well, let's be honest, they're all white, they're all thin, they are, you know, wealthy, they can wear great clothes, you know, and that is a real problem still, you know. But then there are these moments, I mean, when she was struggling with the breastfeeding early on with Brady, I mean, you know, just extraordinary moments of possibility, you know, bearing in mind that Rachel had just had Emma on Friends, and we never saw this child. This child lived in a room somewhere, and she would go out and look great. And so it was a wonderful counterpoint, in a way, to what was going on NBC.
Well, and also there was the equality issue as well, where she had to go into work and ask for her hours to be cut to like 50 hours a week if she was ever going to make it. And there was this reality of working with a child. She's a single parent, going in with sick on her shoulder, and she hasn't got time to shower. And, you know, that was quite revolutionary, actually. We hadn't seen that before on a show like this.
And then there's a retrenchment.
Yeah.
I do have a real question.
Sorry, I have to I have to interrupt you because I get signaled by the very cautious Sabine that we obviously we have to finish now. Yeah. Yes.
Well, so it okay. Sounds like famous.
Catch up late.
I guess this yeah. is some kind of acceptable reason to put Brexit.
We'd love to stay, absolutely.
We have now reached, obviously, the end of this weekend. And I would like, before you all leave, to take the occasion to thank everybody having contributed to here, which of course is the people who had contributions here, but also like the technical staff of the Academy with Wolfgang Augustin, Robert Kaiser, Irmela Notdorf, Guntram Kiefer, auch natürlich die drei Kameraleute, die hier drei Tage lang ununterbrochen gedreht haben. Anton Wenzel, Benjamin Nolde, Björn Hahn. Natürlich vor allen Dingen, in allererster Linie, Sabine Schröder, die das also in dieser hervorragenden Weise alles geleitet hat. Und nicht zuletzt natürlich Markus Merz, der diese ganze Sache ja doch eingefädelt hat, muss man sagen. Dankeschön und guten Heimweg und bis zum nächsten Mal.